Welcome to Sustain and Innovate Conference by Performance Days and Sports Fashion by SAZ. You are listening to an expert talk from November 2019. Mr. Nicholas Allen, Senior Manager, Traceability and Animal Welfare Patagonia presents Greenwashing, the Elephant in the Room.
You have come to find out what's in Nick's brain. And although Nick is quite wise on a whole number of subjects, he's actually a specialist, so he can't answer everything about Patagonia. You must excuse him that he is not brilliant. He's just a specialist who's really, really good. But we're going to run through a couple of subjects. Just to give you a background, the subjects, we have not practiced this whatsoever, because I want to hear Nick's real reaction to these questions. This will be a whole load of words which you'll be very familiar with, associated to the subject of CSR. I have devised a few questions to ask Nick. Oh, by the way, I'm Charles. For those who don't know me, I'm a lecturer at the Royal College of Art. I'm a bit of a fabric geek. So this is where we're going to start. This is the bit where I shut up, but I formally introduce Nicholas Allen, the Traceability and Animal Welfare Manager of Patagonia. Nick, can I pass it over to you? We have questions on the backdrop.
Sure.
How would you like to contribute?
Sure, I will give a very brief explanation about who I am and what I do. So I am the traceability manager and also animal welfare at Patagonia. I am from California myself, but I have been living in Barcelona for over 20 years now, which is actually where I'm based. And the question that I actually get asked the most is, do we have an office in Barcelona? Because everybody wants to work there. But no, I'm sorry. It's just me and my co-working space. I work within the social and environmental responsibility department at Patagonia, and Patagonia has a lot of sustainability initiatives and people who are handling sustainability. My area looks at supply chain, and specifically within supply chain, we're looking at the social and the environmental impacts, and even more specifically, so drilling down more, is traceability. And what we're really talking about there is the evidence that we have to back up our sustainability content claims regarding materials. We have a lot of sustainable materials. And so it's a big job, and it's one that I've been doing for 5 years now. And it's something that has sort of grown and evolved since I've been there, but it's increasingly part of the work that we're doing because of a lot of our goals. So I can explain a little bit about my background. I think that was one of the questions you had. I was not born a traceability manager, and in a way, like what Charles said, I'm not brilliant. So in a lot of ways, I have to see things firsthand. I have to be able to touch them in order to understand sort of a lofty concept. So I went to grad school and I studied international trade policy, which is very nebulous in many ways. And at the time, it was something that seemed so arcane because it was focused on trade and tariffs and the World Trade Organization and things that were very hard to sort of pin down. There was a lot of talk about impact of supply chains on the environment and on social development, on labor rights. But, I didn't have any experience with factories. I'd never been in one before. So what I ended up doing afterwards was going to work for a company that did audits in factories on behalf of brands. So this company was bought by a bunch of different companies, but is the last iteration was Underwriters Laboratories bought it. It's a very big company. And what we did was mostly we would do social compliance assessments in factories on behalf of textile brands. mostly American, but not all. And when I was hired, I basically was given everything that was not core social responsibility work. And it started off by looking at what was then called cargo security. And so what I started doing, my first job basically was going to Mexico, being thrown into factories on behalf of our clients. And I had no idea what I was looking at, but I started to learn quickly. And then I was sent to different parts of the world to look at factories there as well. So I started off by doing security work, looking very much at how does material get sent and is it safe. And from there I got into counterfeit and gray market goods and trying to avoid that at factories. And then from there I got handed the conflict minerals traceability topic, which was something that was very much in the public eye around 2009, 2010. And it mostly is in the electronics sector that this is this was the focus, but also in some precious minerals like gold. And now it's expanded. So what we were asked to do as auditors, which was to go to smelters or refineries and to make sure that they were not sourcing from places that were contributing to conflict, especially in the Congo or in Central Africa. So that's my first foray into traceability. I got to go and look at where our material is coming from, look at documentation, invoices, chain of custody information regarding transportation, and then look at the actual smelter itself. And is the material that they're buying getting mixed and swapped with other material that is coming from potentially dodgy sources? There were not a lot of people, and there are still not a lot of people who actually do this work. So luckily, that's what led me to Patagonia. And at Patagonia, I started off really looking at work that we were already doing in traceability. And at the time, a lot of it was to do with goose down and animal welfare in goose down. And then since then, it's expanded. It's gone into wool, organic cotton, and recycled materials more and more. So what I do on a daily basis, basically to give you an idea, or else it does seem very nebulous, and that's not what I like to do. I like to be able to explain really what it is that I do. We have a lot of sustainability claims, content claims around our material, our products. So, for example, organic cotton or recycled polyester, recycled nylon, ethically sourced, humane down or wool. So we have a lot of claims in different media. We have films and blogs and our product pages. We have email blasts. But we also have two marketing seasons. For a textile brand, for a brand, that is very little nowadays because a lot of fast fashion can have up to 24 or more seasons. We have two. So what that means for us is we have fall and spring are our two main seasons. And we have a big campaign and a bunch of subsequent smaller ones. And in our, for example, fall 19, we had a lot of stories that were going to be coming out. Fall 19 is the season that is currently being sold in Patagonia stores and on our website. So we were going to have a lot of different sustainability angles, and it ended up affecting about 100 product styles. So what I have to do when I know what those stories are is look at the style, look at the material, and then contact our suppliers and ask for evidence to back up that content claim. So if it's for organic or recycled, a lot of times this is certification. For materials where there is no certification, we have to do other things. But one thing that happened last year was that we have our Better Sweater, our iconic Better Sweater, and our story was it's essentially 100% recycled in everything except for the most minor detail, which are the zipper teeth. So that means that I have to reach out to every single material supplier of that product to back up our content claim. And so what I did, we have main body fabric, we have webbing, we have buttons, we have zipper tape, we have main labels, you know, it goes on. And so for each of those, because we're making this broad claim, we actually have to gather evidence. And if we don't have evidence, I go back to our marketing team and I explain, we don't have evidence for this. We should not include this in our claim. So that is one example. This basically is one part of my job. I also help with vetting of new suppliers. And in Patagonia, we have a process which is called the fourfold process for vetting all new suppliers. All suppliers that want to work for us have to be approved by the business end of things, quality, social, and environment. And I'm sort of in between social and environment. But before we actually approve them, each of those areas has to give a yes. And if anyone gives a no, then they're not approved. Onboarding suppliers can take a long time at Patagonia, but when we do it, we don't do it very often. And so when we do it, we want to make sure we're doing it right. So that is another part of what I do. And then after that, I'd say we have a lot of requirements regarding certification that we have to keep up on. We ask our suppliers to be certified to third-party standards. And first of all, we have to research those standards and make sure that they actually are good, that they have teeth behind them, that there's good auditors, that there's good training. And then for down and for wool, we are certified as a brand. So 100% of the suppliers from the farm all the way through to the finished product have to be certified. And for organic cotton, it's the same thing. For us, that's a lot of material and increasingly recycled. So in spring 20, 75% of all of the synthetics that we use will be recycled. And for 2025, our goal is to have no virgin petroleum inputs, essentially, at all. So that means pretty much everything is going to be somewhat related to a sustainability claim, and we need to have evidence to back it up. So really, that is a lot of what I do. The best part of my job is actually not having to do with certifications or audit reports, but visiting suppliers, which is where you learn things. So I've been able to go to all over. I've been to New Zealand to look at wool and Poland to look at goose farms and slaughterhouses, which is not so much fun. And I've been to Italy, to Prato, to look at recycled wool and cashmere. And I've been to the port of Barcelona to look at marine waste that's being collected for one of our suppliers to use in a fiber. And then when you go there, you really see what is on the ground. What is it like? There's, you know, ladies in Prato that are separating sweaters and cutting off buttons, and this gets shredded and turned into a new yarn. That's really interesting, because otherwise you'd think it's a great big, you know, factory and, you know, very high tech, but a lot of times it's not. So
I've run into Nick a fair amount over the last couple of years, and when you are the traceability manager at Patagonia, I thought it was going to be a wonderful life. The more I speak to Nick, the more I find two frustrations. One, there are quite often not systems, and Nick has actually had to create systems. So it's not what Karen was explaining with the HIG before us, where you are complying with the system. Patagonia have genuinely created a system, and trying to create a fair system is complicated enough, let alone applying it in a field where nobody has it. There's obviously going to be mass failure to start with until people come on board and do it the right way. So Nick, you joined Patagonia after it had been exposed like the North Face for live plucking down. You were there when you launched the traceable down system. Reflecting back now on the systems work that you have done, what wisdom have you got? What, as in, how would you reapply a new system or restart a system or identify where a system is going back? What can you help us with the audience about the problems of creating a system? Hmm. And it's a difficult question.
Yeah, totally.
But whilst Nick's thinking of that, Nick made a brief intro right at the start about dodgy Congo, the DRC. If you guys don't know of Falling Whistles, the charity that investigates the geopolitical industry that looks at coltan and tantalon, which is in all your mobile phones, I presume nobody here supports child soldiers. If you are carrying a flat screen capacitor, you are parley to that, unfortunately. So please take note, but hopefully I've bought Nick 30 seconds thinking time.
Sure. Basically, I would say I can compare and contrast wool and down because they're very similar in some ways. For down, really what we found is that we took our existing supply chain and we went backwards to map it. And that was huge because, you know, we have our tier two suppliers, our fabric supplier of down. But then after that, they tell us where the material comes from, more or less. But up until we took our down journey, we didn't really know 100% all of the processors and slaughterhouses and farms that were contributing to it. So that mapping took a long, long time. And then after that, we developed our standard. We also were working with the Textile Exchange and with other brands, with the outdoor industry groups. And then we didn't sort of finally share all of their goals. We went our own way and pursued a different standard, which we felt really looked at the most pressing issue with animal welfare for geese, which was live plucking at the parent farm level. So we did do this mapping, develop our standard, and then roll it out. And that really was a lot of work. It ended up working fine. We do every year from the goose season, basically, is short. It is from about May until September. That's how long geese usually live, the ones that are going into the meat supply chain. And so all audits have to take place in that period. For us, that could be up to over 200 entities altogether need to be audited every time this happens in a short period. It's really intense. So the mapping took, we went sort of back up to do the mapping for this. For wool, it was slightly different. We really stopped with wool at the time, and instead, we consulted with experts, and we were also working with the Textile Exchange on the Responsible Wool Standard, which was doing a lot of work, but we knew it wasn't going to get 100% to what we wanted, so we consulted with American animal welfare expert Dr. Temple Grandin, who's a real inspiration, super interesting person, and she let us know that a lot of the problems with animal welfare for sheep were actually once they've left the farm. So what we decided to do is to take an existing standard, the Responsible Wool Standard, and add on to it, and then find suppliers, farmers, who are willing to meet this. And that was really challenging, but we did. We found suppliers who were willing to meet it, and then what we did was basically construct the supply chain between us and the farmer. So before, we respected existing supply chains and mapped it back, and in this one, we really sort of built it once we had already found willing suppliers. And it was super hard, and it's never, you know, stuck in one place. And the thing that a lot of people don't understand about supply chains is, especially people who are not in this sector, brands don't own them. That's number one. And that they are not static. They move all the time. And especially with anything that is a commodity, a sort of farm-based, a farmer has to choose every year what they're going to do, if they're going to raise geese or if they're going to raise corn, or if they're going to raise cotton, or if they're going to do chickpeas. And so we don't know that if we go to this, you know, this farm this year, it's going to be doing the same thing next year. So this, we do exercises to map our entire supply chain for a certain commodity. And then it could be that next year it looks quite different. And it is really tricky in that sense. So I would say those are the two different things that we've done. In some ways, it's easier to find partners and build the supply chain. But then again, that's not my job, so it could be really hard.
For reasons of political correctness, we have the traceable down standard. A lot of you will be familiar with the responsible down standard. We have Codex. And we also have Fjällräven, who have actually made the whole system redundant by owning the farms that the geese are on. But the contrast is how Patagonia have kept the traceable down standard. The traceable down standard still has peculiar things about it. And I know you have lobbied the textile exchange to actually open the RDS to include these things, and that is an ongoing conversation. But the way that they have come back to the textile exchange and actually gone to work with the RWS, and then the main thrust that I get from my colleagues at the textile exchange is how they are lobbying it to improve it continually. I think it's a mutual recognition. There's no perfect standard. So whether you go alone or whether you create your own. But I'm conscious that we're almost halfway through our time. I want to attack some of the questions on the board, and then I want to open it up to the audience because they'll have far better questions than we know. So the first one, sustainability trends. We've heard lots of key buzzwords. Which are the ones which are getting the most traction with you? Is it the blockchain of the future? Is it, what would you say, Nick?
For traceability specifically, I would say it is either physical tracers of material or blockchain is what is getting the most buzz. And I would say blockchain is a type of technology. Really what that is like a digital way of doing all the mapping and collecting evidence and documents. Currently, that is super retro. I deal in PDF documents, email, and spreadsheets. That's it. And it was now getting better. But the digital sort of aspect of it, if you're going to use a service provider or if you're going to use a blockchain, you know, you have to really look into it because there are a lot of implications for suppliers, not to mention cost, and not just for suppliers but for brands too. We're all following blockchain to see how it's gonna shape up. I think that it has one of the biggest challenges that I see is that it's relying on a fairly sophisticated entry point. So, you know, a factory that works with an SAP system, or you know, an ERP system somehow that can, you know, download this, that it can be uploaded to blockchain, and et cetera, et cetera. My thought is always, what about the cotton farmer in India as a smartphone, or what about the goose farmer in Poland? I mean, I don't know that I would know how to get on blockchain. So it's asking a lot for them to do that as well. And developing any system, any database is within a brand takes everyone in the company to get involved, takes forever. It's long and boring and expensive. So, you know, until they get that ready and easy, I think you're going to find a lot of people are still going to do wait and see. Tracers, I think, are very interesting. So they've been around for a while, you know, DNA tracers or other types of things where you can, for example, spray this material on your cotton and then test it later in your yarn and your fabric and your finished goods. That's super interesting because if traceability currently is document-based or audit-based or visiting-based, then something that is science-based is way better because it's like RSL testing. You send in your sample, they test for it, yes, no. And that's something that, you know, us and a lot of people are looking at. There's also others that can, without applying a material, can test origin through microbiome or through trace minerals, things like that, which, you know, we're looking at as well. But it, you know, we do live in today. Those things are a little bit further out. But, you know, it is something that I suspect will be the norm, you know, in a few years. It will be, you know, basically my job will be that. We'll be working on those systems alone, you know, or artificial intelligence will be doing it. I don't know.
And to progress on from that, presumably I have a lot of brands here. What other flags would you put up that people should be paying attention to for where legislation, where an audit system should be incoming? Patagonia made the monumental move in the, was it the 80s or the 90s? It was the turnover to go to organic cotton.
96.
That started because you had retailers and you had shop staff falling ill because the air conditioning for the formaldehyde for cotton. You're seeing an awful lot of other areas. Where do you hope it progresses next? So what flags would you give out to people, as in, we have a set situation at the moment, but we desperately need to improve it?
You mean like in terms of a new fiber, a new technology that needs some oversight, or?
Both fibers and auditing processes.
Uh-huh. Right. Well, one thing that I always think is important is, for if you are going to rely on a third party, whatever that is, if it's going to be an auditing company or it's going to be a certification, you should go and observe it. You should shadow, and you should ask to also see, you know, the nitty-gritty, the training of auditors, you know, how they select people. Things like that are actually really important. And one example would be for geese. It turns out that it's not super easy to tell if a goose is stressed out or not unless you know about geese. And I have cats and dogs, and I don't know. I can't tell. So you need to have experts who are animal welfare experts who can go and look at that. It's an example, but it's also the same thing for social compliance. You know, you can't necessarily send a quality inspector to go do a social compliance audit because they won't have the soft skills to do an interview with workers to ask them if they're feeling, you know, put upon in some way. So you really do have to look at that. You can't just step back too much. It's when you have a volume of work that you have to be, you know, managing all these different things. And in a lot of brands, the issue is headcount, because the person doing traceability is also doing social compliance and the chemical management, and you know, and there's one person and they don't get listened to. That's a really big problem. So you do have to rely on external you know, systems and structures, but you have to do a lot of due diligence before you trust them. And in certifications, there's a similar thing. You should look at the, is an audit, an on-site audit required, or is it not? Because there's a big difference there. And audits are not a magic weapon. That is one day, one person viewing what they see. It's a snapshot in time. But it is better than relying on a piece of paper or a self-assessment or an affidavit, which you would really stay away from.
And how about new materials that you're seeing coming through, new fibers or, yes, ingredients? Yeah. We are an ingredient show, aren't we?
Right. Well, I mean, I am not a material developer, but I think it's super interesting to hear about recycled ocean plastics. That is, you know, something that you see a lot of. We are also really interested in that. We've been investing in a company called Bureo, which is taking fishing nets from Chile and is turning them into hat brims for us, our hat, our baseball cap, trucker hat. So for spring 20, 100% of our baseball caps are going to be coming directly traceable to these fishing nets from Chile. And but it is an area where there's a lot of people entering quickly. So I think it's important that messaging around the content, origin, where is it blended with other things, is something that can be confusing to people in the industry and definitely to consumers. So, you know, I think that brands should be wary when they look at that. Really look into it and understand what you are promoting and what image you're giving to. I'm not in marketing. I don't do storytelling. I check the story. So that's why I'm always thinking in that way. So those two things, obviously biosynthetics are really interesting. That's something that everybody is really interested to get into. And one thing I know about that is that you have to look at the feedstock. So we want to move away from petroleum, but what are you getting in there in its place? Is it going to be something that is even more destructive in terms of deforestation or farming, or, you know, or social compliance? So there's no easy answer, and it takes a lot of people to assess it. If you ever get an easy answer, it's usually that you haven't dug deep enough, you know. And at Patagonia, we're lucky. We've got a lot of people who are super smart, and they can do a lot of this assessment. But, you know, it's something to keep in mind is when you rush away from one thing, what are you rushing into?
And on that subject of easy answers, this is the bit where I turn it over to the floor. You've heard me pick his brain. I pick Nick's brain about twice a year. But this is your opportunity. Would anyone like to? I'm dashing off to get them already.
Thanks, Charles. Hi, Nick. It's a comment, if I may, and then a question. Just on blockchain, I think it's fascinating, actually, that whole kind of traceability side of things. But I was listening to a really interesting program on BBC fairly recently, which was about the country of Georgia, where blockchain mining, for some reason, has really taken off there. 4% of their total energy use for the country is blockchain mining. So it's kind of traceability is amazing, but at what cost almost? So kind of leading on to that, my question really is around, we're a very small brand with lofty ambitions to be as sustainable as we genuinely can be. How would you recommend to a small brand that we can kind of take those steps forwards? I imagine at Patagonia it's a bit easier to ask those probing questions to your suppliers, but you know, we don't have the people that we can send out to be knocking all the doors. So have you got any tips for very small brands like ours?
Yeah. I mean, I think that what we have looked at in terms of, for example, our environmental impact. We looked at the all of our operations, all of our stores, all of our offices, and ended up seeing that about 97% of our environmental impact really is in the supply chain. And of that, about 85% is materials. So, you know, really choosing your material, doing your research, and finding ones that have the least impact but are still durable, people will want to buy, and will want to keep, and possibly can repair. I think those are things that are always important to keep in mind. But obviously, your a big impact as a textile brand is your materials, and then rely on industry. I really, you know, do rely a lot on the Textile Exchange. They have a lot of really, you know, smart people looking at all of this. But also, there's others as well. There's, you know, there's NSF International that does a lot of our work, and then there's, you know, there's certifications like BlueSign and others which can really help you. It's a very big world out there, so you do have to maybe take a step. Don't get overwhelmed. Take one step, look at one line of your work and see what you can do there. And, you know, it gets easier once you know your learnings from that. Move on to another product line until you can maybe cover all of your naturals, for example, and then look at synthetics afterwards. Something to always sort of chop things up a bit so it's not too overwhelming.
One of my key reflections is that there is not an answer that we know what we're going towards. We know the direction, and the fact that you're making progress, however small the step is what you should be doing. You're not able to achieve the goal. As I've said, we don't know where the goal is, but please get in process, start the movement. But the next one.
Maybe just picking up the question, I mean, we are in the age of platforms. So could it be possible to create a worldwide platform where small brands just get your knowledge, what you experienced already, maybe paying some fees or whatever? Because yes, the small brands cannot invest sending somebody and checking and doing all that stuff. It takes ages. So, but they can just get the best out of your experience within a platform. Is this something you're working on, or could this be a possibility?
I talk to a lot of brands, tiny and large, pretty often. In fact, that's one of our goals that we always have every year is outreach to explain, you know, our journey. We started off not very big either. In fact, we are not very big. I think as a company we have about 3,000 employees. It's not huge. So, you know, we can empathize in that sense. In terms of participating in a platform, I just don't know of any. I haven't heard of that you know, being developed yet, but I'm pretty sure it would.
Create.
What's that?
Let's create one.
Yeah, we'll create one. That would be great. Totally. I'm sure there's some consultants out there that have tried to do something like that. Wherever there is a need, there will be a consultant. But, you know, I'm definitely happy to talk to you, a brand individually. I do it fairly often or, you know, through industry groups and stuff like that as well. That's what usually it gets funneled in through is through, you know, the European Outdoor Group or the Outdoor Industry Association, things like that. But, yeah, you know, get my email if it is. There you have it.
Yes, we've got Nick's email on board. Please don't email me. Please email Nick. And he's really good at questions. If he can't answer the questions, we might be able to find someone else. But the next question, your opportunity, Annalie.
Oh. Hi guys, hi Nick. If you had the opportunity, the whole industry just stopped today and we got a chance to restart tomorrow, and you had the ability to build a supply chain from scratch, what would be your first of, you know, port of call? Would you start right at the root and that would be where you would invest? What would be your sort of ideal scenario in setting up the perfect supply chain for a product?
Oh, yeah, what you just said. No, but it is true. I think that knowing what you're looking at and what your goal is, obviously, you know, you, for example, you know, with, as I mentioned, with wool, it's we had an idea what we wanted, and then we found the farm supplier, and then we, you know, built the supply chain sort of between us and them, which was a lot easier because, or else trying to, you know, and you know how it is, there, these tiers in your supply chain seem so clear, but between each tier, there's multiple agents and traders, and they have no incentive to be transparent. So in a lot of ways, it's way easier to you create the building block and then find willing supply chain partners to link you to. And there will be, obviously. I think one of the questions you had before, which was transparency or traceability, you know, and the thing is, you cannot have traceability if you don't have transparency, because if someone says no, they say no. And unless you are, you know, enormous as a brand, you do ultimately rely on your supply chain partners. You know, they are the gatekeeper. And also traceability, why? You know, do you really need to do this? Could maybe the impact that you're looking for doesn't need to happen through traceability? You know, the Textile Exchange is working on the Responsible Leather Roundtable, I believe it is, and they've ultimately come up to the conclusion that leather traceability is so hard, and it's been tackled so many times, or tried to be tackled so many times, and it's never gotten anywhere. Maybe instead of, you know, having one more failed attempt, let's try to do, you know, impact credits and, you know, support it this way. I think you have to, one size does not fit all. These systems maybe don't work for different materials. In my own experience, the easiest really was with this, finding partners at the farm level. The same thing goes with our regenerative organic program that we're working on right now. You know, we were lucky. We had really good experience with a couple of our suppliers in India who have traceability to the farms for at least part of their organic cotton. And they were willing to do the mapping, find the partners, and then do this pilot with us to roll out the regenerative organic certification, which, you know, is trying to go with organic, but go beyond it, try to improve soil, look at animal welfare and social conditions on the farm as well, which is really advanced and super hard to do. So in order for that to happen, really, we relied on someone who could find the farm first. If we tried to do that otherwise, it could take so long that it takes a lot of the initiative off. You know, these things in a company, you do kind of, once you have buy-in, you need to go. You can't let it stall for 3 years because it could die on the vine. So it's my idea. But yeah.
Annalie, from the point of view of this industry, we get obsessed by the down on the wool and also the cotton. they're actually byproducts of the meat industry, and they're actually the low-value byproducts of the meat industry. So the farmers are so focused on their biggest revenue earner. What we're doing is just working with their waste. So hence, there's not the concentration. But I know you know that. We've got time for one final question before we get kicked off. And if you don't ask it, I will.
So out of curiosity, how many full-time sustainability or traceability employees does Patagonia have out of the 3,000? And as part of that, when really did that, I mean, Yvonne at heart was that from the beginning, but when did that, let's say, department really form within Patagonia?
I can answer the first part a bit easier. I wasn't there. So I've been there for 5 years, and it was already fairly established by the time I got there. I know that there were some people dealing with sustainability from way back when. It's been very decentralized, so it is kind of hard to say. I will say supply chain, which is really what my focus is. I really think it's probably from about mid-2000s, so around in there. But I mean, we've had these gurus like, you know, Vincent and Rick Ridgway and Yvonne Chouinard. Like, these guys, sustainability was their thing before it was an industry thing in a way.
You guys wrote The Responsible Co, which is
those guys
definitive book on the subject. If no one has really absorbed The Responsible Co, get it. 125 pages of text, 250 pages of references. I didn't understand it until my fourth attempt at reading it, but it is the answer.
But yeah, I mean, I think that they had the initial idea, and then as the company grew and we had a bigger supply chain, someone had to dedicate their full time to that. And I think I would say we're somewhere around like 10 to 12 people altogether. We've also got people overseas, which are what we call field managers, and they are located in country. They're locals, and they have relationships with the factories, both mostly tier one, but also some tier two as well. And so, yeah, it's a team of the supply chain end of things is somewhere around that 10, 12 people, something like that. And traceability is meat. So.
Nick, we're going to get chucked off stage. Eureka's making eyes at me. Can I ask everyone to show the appreciation? I might be a nerd. This is a guy who knows the detail.
Thank you for listening to Sustain and Innovate Conference by Performance Days and Sports Fashion by SAZ. To get your free ticket for the next fair or listen to other expert talks, go to performancedays.com. Copyright November 2019 by Design and Development GmbH Textile Consult. All rights are reserved.